Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 8th, 2019. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. So, Mariah, many years ago, I had the good fortune to be sent on a business trip to a place called Singapore. So this is probably the late 1990s. And I remember at the time very clearly that in the downtown, there were big signs over the city streets saying when you could drive into the downtown and when you couldn't. It was called congestion. They called it congestion pricing, which basically regulated how many cars could drive into the center of a city. And now all these years later, it seems like it's not such a bad idea, especially from a climate perspective and just general quality of life in the city. So as far as
I can attest to that.
So tell me what's happened recently that connects Singapore to the United States?
Well, so as I was driving over the Tobin Bridge, which right now is currently has one lane closed due to construction, think it's like a 2 or 3 year long construction, yeah. Right? So I work in the city. I teach it at Boston University and commute with an electric car, but I do commute in and out. When I can, I take the train. But today I was driving out and I was, stuck in all of this traffic getting over the bridge. And lo and behold, WBUR's On Point had this whole segment about congestion pricing. And I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I would consider that a good idea and, get more people into the train, including myself. But the WBUR piece was focusing on, I think it's Albany, New York, which is now looking toward congestion pricing to help relieve some of the traffic in the city. And, they were looking to some of the, so London has done it, Stockholm, Singapore, as you mentioned. I believe that some places, maybe Madrid in Spain, is doing like sort of an odd number.
And I had heard that New York City itself was going to do it in 2020, right?
I think they were talking about Albany, New York, but maybe they were actually talking about New York City. Right. I may have that wrong. I know Boston is also something that Boston is trying to figure out as well, part of the Carbon Free Boston.
I know that in Beijing that you can only drive in, you drive in on odd and even days depending on the last number of your license plate.
Right. Yeah. There's places
doing that. Yeah. So yeah. Did it say how congestion pricing sounds great, but it somehow implies that either they've got a transponder in everybody's car or they're taking pictures of license plates as you drive in and out of the controlled area? Did they say anything about the pragmatic logistics of doing it?
They may have. I didn't catch that piece of it. The thing that they were talking about is the fact that there's a lot of exemptions, and it gets tricky. Like some of the congestion problems that we have right now are all of the Ubers and Lyfts, which are also part of the solution, right? There's more carpooling there, and it means people don't have to have a car. Mm-hmm. But they do sort of clutter up things. And in a lot of these places, taxis are exempt from congestion pricing. And so they were kind of addressing those loopholes and what do those do to sort of cause hiccups and make the system not effective. And I think that's a good question. What does get an exemption? What doesn't get an exemption? How does everything kind of play out?
It seems to me there's lots of goods and bads about congestion pricing, right? Congestion pricing should lower carbon pollution, right? Will give an assist to mass transit. So I guess some sort of document from Paul Krugman saying that the New York City congestion pricing proposal, I guess the money that you're going to pay to go into New York City for the privilege of driving in New York City, that money will then be transferred over to the mass transit system in New York, which needs a boost of cash, right? It's even, they're really in trouble in New York City to get the subways back. And Krugman was making the argument that this is a good thing. It's linking something that generally people would not want to do, that is to pay money to drive in the city, to a societal good of improving the subway system. And so there you go. It's a good deal, and that it's kind of a model for the Green New Deal, that, you know, some stuff you got to pay for, but you get other good stuff back, and you have this sort of Christmas tree arrangement of things, the good and the bad, a little spoonful of sugar in with your medicine to make it all go down, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think one of the big problems that I see for the congestion pricing, you're just talking about exemptions. I mean, somebody with money isn't even going to notice a $2 a day fee to go into drive into New York City or potentially downtown Boston. But somebody who is not making as much money and needs to drive in, it's going to hurt them, right? So how do you adjudicate or rationalize the relative impact of even a low congestion price for someone who doesn't have the money versus someone for whom the money's no problem to drive in and out?
Well,
I don't know.
So, you know, one of the things that has been sort of bandied about for Boston is, you know, you charge more for people who are single occupancy vehicles driving into the city, and you use that to offset the cost of the train, right? You either make the train free, you know, or steeply subsidized so that it's very cheap to take the train into the city, and that helps get the cars off the road and also make accessible transportation for people who, kind of a tax, or so to speak, of driving a single occupancy vehicle might affect them. Well, you get them onto a train for free,
or
a bus system. Of course, there's logistics there that may be challenging.
Well, I mean, you're back to the whole question of you're trying to make a societal transition, right? You want that transition to be just. So if you're making it a thing that you have to pay to drive into a city like Boston, right now we're talking about New York City, but in general, an urban area, it's a good thing from a carbon perspective to reduce the carbon footprint, but you working out how it's going to be fair to everyone involved is less clear, right? Unless
right.
you just ban all automobile traffic in a downtown area, which wouldn't be the worst thing in the world either, right? That's also a fair way to get it. And then everyone has to take mass transit, and everyone has to be bought into the idea of...
Or ride a bike.
The trains are going to be good.
Copenhagen, I'll tell you, Copenhagen is amazing. You go into that city and you go to a stoplight, and there's like 40 bikes and two cars, you know? I mean,
I've never been in, you must have been there, right? Well, I think that the question of, I don't think there's any concrete proposals to do something similar in Boston, but certainly there is a move to make many of the highways more of the roads toll roads, which would then require everyone to have a transponder in their car. And I think going forward, you're going to see more and more smart cars that are talking to each other all have these transponders built in. But, I mean, that's a way, ultimately, I think, to manage who gets to go in and out of the city. Because, you know, in a way, you could at that point, if you were tracking which cars went in and out of the city electronically, you could have the cost to drive in and out of the city be proportional to your income tax statement or something, right? So that then you sort of realign... make equitable the cost for everyone to drive in and out of the city.
They talked about is sort of tying it to the miles you drive, right? I would think, you know, also is your vehicle efficient? I mean, should I pay the same to drive my electric vehicle that's charged by solar panels on
the Hummer
road? Exactly. I mean, right. So there's all these sort of nuances to things that, you would hope to see in a thoughtful policy.
Right. And as we've said before in different shows, that the next big challenge in Massachusetts for climate related stuff. For carbon emissions is the transportation sector. Right, that's where now a growing proportion of the carbon is emitted through transit. And finding ways to reduce carbon emissions from transit is an important one. And just to touch on what you were saying, I mean, there's this idea of the VMT, a vehicle miles tax, right? So that every time when you renew your insurance each year, you have to report the mileage on your car. And if you've driven more on the roadways, you should pay more. I mean, that can be wildly unpopular among people. I mean, I've seen the reactions that people have. But on the other hand, it's not a crazy idea to say that if you're driving more on the roads, you should pay a little bit higher fee for the privilege of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Right. The privilege to pollute is basically what it comes down to, right?
Right.
You pay to have excess garbage removed in a lot of towns.
Yeah. Yep. So anyway, interesting. Congestion pricing is an idea that you can say you heard it first, if it is the first time you've heard it. You heard it first on the Climate Minute, right?
Unless you were listening to WBUR like I was.
Listening to WBUR today. So there's a slightly different depressing topic that is floating around, and that's that the federal government, the president has now lurched over to the idea of denying foreign aid to certain Latin American countries because he thinks those Latin American countries are not doing enough to stop people from coming to the United States. It's all very unfair and horrible. But there's a couple articles, I don't know if you saw them, Mariah, one in the New Yorker, I heard a Vox podcast that mentioned it, basically saying that right now, many of the people coming out of the triad of countries, this is El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. No, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. That most of the people are coming from Guatemala, where in fact the violence is less, but the malnutrition is higher because many of the people living at high altitude, the weather has changed, i.e., climate change has changed the growing conditions, and people just can't make a living, so they're leaving the country, trying to come to the United States, and so that. All of the ugliness of the American at the American border, at some level, climate change is a contributor. I mean, it's just. Did you see any of that? I mean, did you hear about that?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't. I don't know a lot of detail, but just that the you know loss of precipitation is giving usually an area of land that would feed a family for a year is now lasting them. Barely enough to get them through 5 months.
Right.
So, you know, that's a big deal. And when you can't feed your family, you don't have a choice. You have to go somewhere to be able to feed your family.
Right. And I think it's just, again, it's an unspoken thing, but you know, we've said it and we'll have to continue to say it for a long time that immigration and these refugee situations have at some level, there is a climate component. And we need to start taking into account a just immigration policy because it's not going to get better going into the future. I mean, there's going to be more and more people that are displaced through climate issues. And if we've set precedents that are ugly and unjust, that's not a good thing for the future of the planet. So, So Mariah, I got one more thing I want to throw at you. Hear what you have to say about it. I am trying to decide, as a good American citizen who votes almost religiously, who votes in a very regular way. There's an election coming up next year. I don't know if you heard about it yet. We're going to have another one of those crazy presidential elections.
What? Really? Are there Democratic candidates already?
There are a few Democratic candidates. Of course,
is it kind of 20 right now?
Yeah. We never try to pick winners and losers in the in political debates. But I think as climate hawks, I think it's a fair discussion to wonder where to put your energy. Right? If you're a person that cares about climate change, wants it to be an issue in the presidential campaign, what should you do? And it seems to me there are two choices. One choice is to say, I'm going to pick the best climate candidate that I see out there. That whether he or she, whoever it is, and I'm going to work like a dog to back that candidate. That's my strategy to maximize the impact of climate change issues on the presidential campaign. it seems to me an alternate way is to somehow try to shape the discussion so that the eventual winner of the primary, no matter who she is the ideal climate candidate. And it's not clear to me how to do that second thing, but I think it's a fair question as to which strategy, I guess I'm looking at myself, I'm looking in the mirror, which strategy I personally would want to follow. Would I want to pick a climate hero and work for that person, or do I want to try to argue that all the candidates should move in a certain way? And I guess I developed in my own head kind of a criteria that I was calling, a climate qualified candidate, right? What does it take for me to think that a presidential candidate is qualified to discuss the climate issues? And I came up with the idea that the candidate has to comprehend the urgency of the issue. They have to get it. They have to understand how big and serious and societally consequential climate change will be. Right? Second important point I think that a presidential candidate should have is an explanation of how she will implement the necessary changes. By that I mean, the president can promise anything. Right? And then when he gets in, he can't act, right? Obama did that. He said he was going to do great things, but then the Congress wouldn't let him act, right? So how are we going to get around that? What are you going to do to build a movement to have enough other people with you? As president, what are you going to do to have enough other people with you to get stuff through Congress? I mean, another idea there is whether or not the presidential candidate is ready to deal with the question of the filibuster. Because no matter what happens, it's likely that the Senate's going to be Republican and you're going to have to get through a filibuster. So nothing's going to happen unless you have a strategy around the filibuster. I can't say I know which way that I feel about that, right? Reasonable people can disagree, but to say that we're going to have a great candidate on climate, but you can't pass anything because the Republicans own the Senate, well, that's a non-starter as far as I'm concerned.
And then, of course, the other thing is the Electoral College, right? That's another thing that's being debated right now.
Absolutely.
As well. Yeah.
But then I think after you get those two things in place, the actual policies that the person espouses are almost less important because you have people to make policy, right? If you've got the commitment and you've got the people behind you, you'll come up with good policy. So I was thinking those are three criteria that you would want to try to force on each of the candidates or judge candidates by. Throughout the election. So tell me, Mariah, which side, what do you think? Are you going to work for a candidate? Or are you going to, let me put it back in your court.
If we can figure out the answer to this question, then we can throw our hats in the ring, right? This is how you solve climate change, and we're going to make it happen. I for sure agree with you that I think that the candidate should be, you want someone who's in some ways has a proven track record of being able to make change happen, whatever that change is, understanding how you can build the movement, how you can get a broad array of people to support what you are trying to push forward. And someone who can do that and then pivot that toward climate, but also, as you said, understands the seriousness behind climate change and how we need to take action. We have 12 years to do something about it. So somebody who's motivational and can get people on board with what they're doing and really start making things happen quickly and isn't afraid to do whatever that takes, to take whatever risks and needed to address that agenda, whatever political risks even, to address that agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I was going so far as, I'm an Excel spreadsheet guy. You must do Excel spreadsheets, right?
I love Excel spreadsheets.
I had, I had all 25 candidates down one column.
And then I had these three,
the four criteria weighted, and I was going to rank every candidate and see which one, and keep track of them. Because what are you going to do with many, many candidates?
That's a question I have. I can't remember the details, but I remember hearing that having so many candidates can be actually very detrimental when you finally get to after you've chosen a candidate for your party and finally to the major election. I would assume it's just because it sort of dilutes maybe the messages that you're trying to, or maybe it strengthens, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an open question. I mean, you would hope that as people drop out, which they will, right, that you get the people that became involved stay involved, right? I mean, so it's as if, suppose you decided that the path you were going to take in the 2020 election, that the most useful thing you could do was to get behind one candidate that you really liked for their climate position and do your best to make them the front runner, right? Is that a net positive for the entire campaign, right? For the eventual winner, if it's not your person? I think that's what you're asking, right?
Yeah.
Is that a way to go? I mean, that's, I guess that's what makes, that's, that is what makes politics interesting, right? I mean,
right, how do you... right. Well, and then on the flip side of that too, is, you know, as a sort of, is you're kind of looking at the candidates and maybe putting some of your money, some of your donations toward the different candidates, that spreads people thin in some ways, mm-hmm. right? If there's mm-hmm. 20 candidates, what did you say, 24 candidates?
Right,
I mean,
right. And you're peeling off your $20 bills to try and keep each
yeah,
one of them,
right.
keep one of them, each one of them alive.
Yeah, and if you, you know, if you're really excited about one candidate and then they don't make it very far, it can be sort of disenchanting. You can become
yeah.
disenchanted with the process or with all of the sort of, you just sort of lose interest in some ways, right? And that can be a challenge too. So, you know, I think it's better to have just a few really, really strong, focused candidates than a lot of candidates who sort of share the same view. So I do hope that we call...
call the pack sometime soon.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to mention an email address, but I'll say it now. podcast@massclimateaction.net. Please send us your opinion about what the right strategy is for a climate hawk to take to maximize their impact on the 2020 election. Right, that's something to, the time has come to start thinking about that. Well, speaking of thinking about things, it's time to think about closing up shop for another show, Mariah.
Sounds good.
We'll put up links to some of the stuff we talked about on the blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. You can check us out on Facebook at /massclimateaction, where there's a lot of other interesting stuff. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using all those wonderful modern podcast distribution apps. Right, it's the Climate Minute under Mass Climate Action Network. If you get confused, go to Apple Podcast, where we also reside. As I said, the email you can send us, the email address you can send your comments to is podcast@massclimateaction.net. Please let us know what you think. It helps us make the show better. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of those things, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for your political advice.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.